Good morning to you once again. Thank you very much for staying with us here in the 9 till noon show. And good morning if you've just tuned in. Where were you? What were you listening to? You missed two very important issues relating to us here in County Donegal. Thanks so much for all your texts and comments coming in. I'll get through some of those right now. Greg, regarding the bike shed and the cost of same, this is like everything else. The government will sit on it until the public forget, and like the Children's Hospital will pay the bill because it's not their money. It feels like that. I know where you're coming from. The price of a family home spent on a bicycle shed for 18 bicycles. And I think our last two texters are being very generous in calling it a shed. You know, it's a suspended canopy, which really, given the Irish weather, would offer very little by way of protection unless the rain fell straight down, which it doesn't tend to do so here. That's an awful lot of money for the 18 bike shed erected at Leinster House. We've 23 bike sheds in Buncrana, and I've yet to see a bicycle in any of them. I think money could have been spent wiser. Thank you. I enjoy the show. Thank you for your comments. Hi, Greg. If I spent €10,000 of my own money building a bike stand for 18 bikes, I would think somebody stuck their arm into me. I think you're right. At the Dáil, spending 336 odd thousand is no big deal for a wee bit of construction. I could build a house for 336. Yeah, Raymond, you could. Many, many people could. And I think you could build a number of units of accommodation for that money as well. What is the tendering process? I always thought with public money being spent that you put a tender out and lots of people would tender and then the cheapest tender got it. Was that process followed in this case or is it exempt from that? I do note that someone who supplies these sheds down the country said he could have done 25 of them for 335,000 instead of that one. A caller says it's time for Donegal County Council and people to take back ownership and control of Donegal Water and chase Irish Water out of the county. Another, what about asking them to get rid of the fluoridation? There are loads of studies that show fluoride stunts kids' intelligence, but a new study shows fluoridation is linked to autism. There are conflicting studies in relation to it, and it seems to be the general medical consensus is that it is safe in certain amounts. But look, you know, there's lots of conversations that perhaps need to be had in that regard. Ask Micheál, why do they not talk to him? Is it because he is harassing them morning, noon and night? The taxpayer that's paying his wages, he should go out of his way to meet them. I don't think he's hard to meet. I don't know. I presume he's not. I think most of our councillors are easy enough to meet. And I suppose they are elected to sort of advocate on behalf of those that elect them. And one of the biggest issues, one of the most contentious issues, not least in West Donegal, is water. And I think if you suffered with a great deal of water outages, you'd want your local rep haranguing these people morning, noon, August night. I'm on holidays in Bundoran at the minute and listening to you, and you mentioned the weather there to your gardener. No one mentions the chemtrails and what they're doing to our weather. The knock-on effect to weather has for our farming and tourist communities is not spoken of enough. I'd like to hear a discussion on them. You can be sure as you can see them, rain will follow. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of people have that view, but if you look at how weather works, where it starts, how it gets here, you look at areas where there's no overflights, and there's rain and different types of weather and the weather changes. I get where you're coming from. I respect your point of view. Do I share it? No. Do I trust that there's any organisation in this world that is A, intelligent enough and organised enough to do this? No, because I don't see anything else that organisations are capable at this scale. And B, keeping it a secret? Do you think they're capable of that? No. I think you would have had Trump or Putin or someone blowing the whistle on it. But anyway, listen, I appreciate your point of view. Greg, if I buy a ticket online for, say, €100 and I try and sell it for €400, I'd be called a ticket tout. A ticket tout. Yes, of course, you would be a ticket tout. But if MCT do it, it's called dynamic pricing. Themselves and Ticketmaster seem to be able to do what they want with ticket prices. It's absolutely ridiculous that a normal standing ticket, which was originally valued at €86, was then costing over €400. What? It is actually legalised daylight robbery. If a tout was charging you that outside Croke Park on concert day, you'd nearly be telling the Gardaí. I'm surprised there's not more of a kick-up about it on your show. I'm also very disappointed with Oasis, as I presumed they had to agree to this dynamic pricing crack. Yes, they did. I always had them down as working-class heroes who came up the hard way. Yeah, indeed, but money talks. Why are they back together in the first place? Rich people will always try and enrich themselves. That's the bottom line. how long will you remember coming up the hard way when you're a multi-millionaire living in that bubble? I don't know. But dynamic pricing is something we see in hotels. It's something we see in airlines. And now we're seeing it in concerts. It's ridiculous. It's robbery. It's false advertisement, I think, because they say, oh, tickets €86 when you get to the end of waiting for hours in a queue and you're told €400. There's something seriously amiss there. But where are the mugs that are paying it? And it's sold out now. So some people paid it. And whilst people continue to do that, they're going to continue to gouge. So farmers, landlords and anybody making a profit gets a wallop. Sinn Féin socialist policy is terrific until they run out of other people's money. This is in relation to the Sinn Féin housing policy. And there's been some interesting commentary on it, not least from government parties. The argument being that government parties, government ministers are saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, that Sinn Féin's House for Everyone policy is effectively, you know, the government owns the land, the government determines who you can sell the house to, the government determines how much you can sell it for. And the government is arguing, the current government is arguing, is that home ownership? It's up to the public to decide. And that's also just the way the government phrased it. Sinn Féin might see it differently. I think people would like to see the real issues dealt with in Donegal, such as the defective concrete block issue and mass migration by freeloaders claiming asylum. These are not the professional people working in healthcare and local industry. Sinn Féin will get what it sows. Another, finally, a housing policy that looks to fix the mess that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have created. A plan to build more social housing, a plan to build more affordable homes, and a plan to make it easier for people to get on the property ladder. Listening to some of the comments coming in, you would think Sinn Féin was in government. The mind boggles. And I think that's the challenge Sinn Féin has, is separating their policies from better the devil you know policies. Is it possible to get a request played for my mum and dad? Yes, of course it is, Shauna. Anthony and Bridie McGonagall. They're in Carromina. They're 50 years married today. Wishing them lots of love and continued happiness from their loving daughter, Shauna, and their one and only grandson, Dylan. Yep, we'll do that for you, Shauna. Happy to do that. Also, too, could you play a special request for Barry Orr? He's celebrating a birthday today. Big shout out to the main man, Barry Orr. Today is his birthday. Hope he has an amazing day. All my love from his best present, his wife, Linda. Okay. We'll see what Barry has to say about that. Greg, you asked how... actually, do you know what? Because I've done those requests, I'll take a break before I move into a more serious topic, because it could sound insensitive and I don't want to do that. So we'll take a break. Here's the bingo numbers. We're back with more in the 9 till noon show in a sec. You're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. And I can welcome onto the programme now author Katrina Cunningham. Good morning, Katrina.
Good morning, Greg.
Great to have you on the show. How are you keeping?
Keeping fine, thank you.
Brilliant. And congratulations ahead of your piece of work to be shown at Ungreen on Theatre on Thursday, September 26th, just for people to mark that early in their diary. And it's called The Marion Hotel. And I would like you, Katrina, in your own words, to describe the story that's told for us.
Well, The Marion Hotel is based in a mother and baby institution, which would have been called a mother and baby home back then. It's based on my own memories of being given birth to my daughter in there. And it is basically about the friendship of women getting together and everything else that happened in there.
What was the... I suppose what we do as humans, do we try and make the best of a bad situation. We try and survive and lean on each other. And I suppose that creates sort of scenarios and interactions in these spaces that you're able to draw on for the material for this work.
Yes, that's right. I think the way to survive when you're in a dark place is to connect with others, and friendships and bonds do form, and it keeps you going from day to day. That and also been in contact with family at home or friends at home through letter. Believe it or not, we wrote letters then. There was no mobile phones or anything like that. So those things really, really kept you sane when we were there. Yeah.
And I suppose, as well as giving us an insight into the actual lived experience of it, are there other elements of this scandal that we don't know about, or that you believe aren't talked about, and that you're able to sort of discuss and platform through this play?
Well, thankfully, you know, it's very timely in a way, although the play's been, you know, I've been writing it for quite a few years, mainly in the last five. But there's actually an independent inquiry going to be, is taking place at the moment here in the north. And it is very timely in that women and their children, now adult children, are coming forward. So there will be different stories or testimonies of people's lives, because it was a very complicated, very, very complicated system. So every day we're hearing from people coming forward and new things. And, you know, we're just hoping that this opens it up even more for debate and for people to come forward.
Are you comfortable telling us sort of, you know, what age you were when you entered one of these facilities and the circumstances around that, Katrina?
Well, I was 19, which I thought at the time I knew everything. I thought 19 was very old to be, as we would have called it, getting pregnant. I was on my own. So I, unlike many, many other women, I decided to go there myself. I had heard of it. I'd heard of Marianvale. I thought it would be like a retreat.
Did you go there for a support structure sort of a thing? I mean,
yes.
Okay, right. So you went in and what was your experience there? Or when did you realise it wasn't quite what you believed it might have been?
The minute I went on the door, basically. It was a convent or attached to a convent, so it was a step back in time anyway. That's what it felt like to me. And the moment I was in, it was very regimented. And the main thing about it was that everything was geared to having your baby adopted, which was not what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be down and people maybe talk to me and just help me through a bad patch in my life. So everything was geared towards adoption.
So did they try and convince you of that? Because you walked in of your own free will, could you have left at any time at all?
Yes, I could have. This is the thing about it. You go into a place like this. First of all, you're thinking, right, this is a place I need to help me through this.
Yeah.
When you start to realise that it's actually not, you're already there, and you feel that you have handed over your future in a way to somebody else.
Wow.
It's easy now to think in hindsight, I should have done this or I should have done that.
No, I know. Because
it was at the time.
I presume there were techniques and language that had been well honed to convince you that it's in your best interest to be there and it's in your baby's best interest for the baby to be adopted. I don't want to use the word professional, but they knew what they were doing. So you can see very quickly how you could find yourself being drawn into that and questioning, you know, what is the right thing for me to do? And you're only hearing one angle on that. Do you think enough is discussed about, and do you talk about this much in your play, about, you know, what happens next? Where do the babies go? What does the mother find out?
Well, first of all, babies were taken without consent from the hospital after women give birth, which was what happened to me. So that is talked about, but it wasn't talked about at all when I was in there. It is talked about in parts of the play, certainly. It has to be, because that's the reality.
So you went full term, okay? You went into labour, you had your baby. How soon after that was your baby taken from you?
I have no idea. I know that she was there because I sneaked down to the nursery to see her a few times, so I know she was there for perhaps a few days afterwards. But I've no idea when she was taken. I still don't know.
I'm so sorry, Katrina, that you and so many people were put through this. It is just absolutely gut and heart wrenching, and it's unbelievable. It really is that you going through all of that and your baby taken from you.
Well, I was one of the lucky ones, Greg, because I did get my daughter back after 3 months. So when she was 3 months old, I got her back. And so I am very, very lucky.
Yeah.
And that is why I speak up and talk in shows like this, because there's other women who can't, for whatever reasons. And it's also to give a voice to those women and their children who are now adults.
The show itself is, how would you describe it in that, you know, I mean, obviously, as well as everything you've gone through and the horror of these homes for most people that were there, you're coming from Northern Ireland too, peak of the Troubles, there's an awful lot going on. How do you want to tell that story? Is there a bit of humour in there, a bit of dark humour? Does it show all sides of I suppose, the human personality?
It is. It is. As I said, you know, it was the friendships that were formed and the humour that keeps you going. So there is black humour, and it was against the background of what they call the Troubles. But, you know, so that's where we were coming in. You know, we were coming in the middle of everything that was going on around us. That is brought into the play as well. That is, you know, because people came from different areas, obviously from all around the north, from the south. So the girls came from different backgrounds and different areas. So you were swapping information as well about what was going on outside, although you weren't encouraged to do so. So, yeah, that all comes into it.
Yeah.
The humour, the war, everything else.
As you may be aware, there's the finding of the scoping report published here in the Republic in relation to church-run schools and abuse within church-run schools. And just as part of that, and about how we speak about what we've been through, there was a study not so long ago done that showed that if you approach people that were in these schools and ask them directly whether you're abused and the answer in the affirmative, for 47% of them, that'd be the first time they actually said it out loud or acknowledged it.
Yes, and I've been following that as well. I've been following what's happening there, yes.
And I think the same is maybe for a lot of people that were in mother and baby's homes. Are you hoping that this gives them the voice? Because when people are asked, they'll say it, but they don't feel like they can come forward and say it. Many don't. Are you hoping that maybe this gives them the strength, encouragement, the backing to do so?
Yes, I am, Greg, because I'm very aware, and this applied to myself as well. I didn't tell anybody for years until very recently that I had been through that system. There's so much shame attached to being in it in the first place, to even have thought of going into it, and also the shame around what was called unmarried mothers back in the day, or even for their children, now adults.
Who were called illegitimate, as if they had no status in the world at all.
Yes. Absolutely, yes. So getting rid of the shame is a big, big barrier to everything. It's shame. And we're trying to break down that barrier and say, this was done to you. Mm-hmm. You didn't do anything wrong. None of us did.
So, I mean, your situation is everyone's is individual. Yours is a little bit different because you still had that intense moment of your child being taken away and that period for 3 months where you didn't know what was going to happen. You were the same as everybody else, right? And as you said yourself, you were very lucky to get your daughter back, and I'm so pleased to hear that. But between that experience and you speaking about it publicly, is it ever present in your mind? Do you put it to your back of your mind? Does it tend to sort of change who you are and affect everything about you? Or, again, it's down to the individual. Were you able to sort of compartmentalise it and park it somewhere?
Well, it's especially around my daughter's birthday, I would always think of all the other women that were there. I wonder what happened to them and their children. But it never, ever goes away. And then the thing I think that started for a lot of women and their children was the Tomb Babies.
Yeah.
When that scandal started to come out and people started to talk more openly. And I think a lot of women and their children were saying to themselves, you know, this, we're still hiding stuff. We're not talking about things. And what about the others? Mm-hmm. What about the women that never saw their children again? And there are so many of them.
Yeah.
And children that never saw their mothers, or when they went to look for their mothers had died.
Yeah.
So,
and these are all connected.
It's all connected.
The cast is a fantastic cast. And you need a fantastic cast to tell such an important story, and that's been assembled. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Katrina?
Yes. Well, I wrote the play and the sole production purposes are putting the play on. Patricia Burns directing it. The cast we had done for the last few years, we've been doing workshops around this with a dramaturg from Belfast, Emily Dacaus. So there's been a lot of work put in. The cast are so enthusiastic. You can imagine a female writer, female director, female dramaturg, female cast. Everybody has become very close, and they're so interested. The younger women are so interested in the subject. And it's unbelievable, because once people get involved in something, they find out that their families may actually have a connection towards these institutions as well, that maybe was never talked about. So it's a very powerful thing, and the cast are amazing. I've every faith in them. They're brilliant. I'm so lucky, and so purpose. We're so lucky to have such great, you know, cast.
Brilliant. Okay, and we're so lucky to have them coming to a beautiful setting on Green On Theatre. It's on Thursday, September 26th. It's called the Marion Hotel, and tickets are available now. You can go to you can ring the box office at On Green On, or go to their website right now and select your ticket. Who do you want to see there? Is it everyone? Is it a general audience, or what? I mean, you know, if you were to get up on stage and look out, who would your dream audience be? Is it people affected by this, or maybe those that aren't as well, so that they actually do get that insight that you deliver about this? We talk about this as if it's 1852 this happened. Up until very, very recently, women were going through this.
Yes,
you know,
this is our... didn't close until the late 80s or early 90s. So no, I'd love to see a general audience. But of course, I'm really, really hoping that within that audience that there's going to be what we would call birth mothers and their children. I'd love that.
Listen, it's been really interesting talking to you, Katrina. Best wishes to you and all. And I'm sure this is going to be hugely popular down here. But thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Katrina. That's author of that play, Katrina Cunningham. It's the Marion Hotel, and it will be shown at On Green On Theatre on Thursday, September 26th. So it should be an interesting show, I've no doubt about it. And you can book your tickets right now on greenon.com, or give the box office a ring. Okay, we are joined on the programme now by Liam Doherty, Chairman of the Donegal Dubai GAA. Good morning to you, Liam.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. What about yourself?
Not bad at all. Not bad. Keeping good.
Living full-time in Dubai for the last 7 years, originally from beautiful Kilcar. What's life like over there for you?
Yeah, really good, Greg. I suppose 7 years here now. One thing you have is sunshine every day.
It's overrated.
You do miss the rain, but... No, going okay. We'll stick it out for another few years. But you do miss home at times, all right.
Of course, and there's great connections too if you want to nip back and what have you. Right, you started a GAA club in Dubai. What was the idea behind it? How did you know the critical mass was there to support it?
Yeah, I guess I've been here 7 years, so I've built up quite a few connections within Donegal. And me and Conor Gibbons from Letterkenny one day were having lunch on a Saturday, and we started talking about the fact that there's a lot of clubs in the UAE, but none that kind of feel like home, or none that you really put on a jersey and want to wear that jersey, you know. So that's where the talk started. Then we looked at how many Donegal people we know in the region, and would there be enough to really start a club. So that's where it started. It was a bit of a passion project last summer, and then this year we decided to go ahead with it. And the reaction's been brilliant, to be honest. Even not just Donegal people, but the wider community, I think, are looking for a social club, or a club that maybe gives a little bit extra. We're not taking it too serious in terms of football. It's more about building a community of people that, whether you're a very good footballer, or you're on or your first time playing, we're offering that kind of a club where you can come in at any stage, you know.
And it's a big club. Currently 60 men, 50 women. So has it expanded? Obviously, they're not all from Donegal, are they? They're from across the country, but even from outside of Ireland, others are getting involved. Is that correct?
Yeah, 100%. So it started off, I suppose, with maybe 15, 20 Donegal lads that we knew would sign up. And as I say, the reaction's been brilliant in terms of, a lot of people from the north, even South Africa, New Zealand. We have a couple of guys from the UK as well that have put their name in the hat. And thankfully tonight will be the first training session. So we're to get bodies on the field tonight. I think we have about 40 men and 30 women all coming tonight. So it's turned into quite a big club. I think when we started, we were talking about potentially having two small teams. Now we're looking at potentially four, maybe five teams, which is, it's more than we expected, but, you know, we welcome it all.
Yeah, and I think you sort of said this a little earlier on. It is a GEA club, but it sounds almost like an Irish social club, not exclusive to Irish, but it's just to sort of get that sense of community and Irish community and home out in Dubai, because I think that's one thing we miss the most when we're away, isn't it? It's our family, but it's also our sort of, it's that sense of community.
Yeah, 100%, Greg. And I think, I lived in London for 3 years, so I knew of Tyr Connell Gales. My brother lived in Philadelphia, where he was involved with Donegal Philadelphia. You've got Donegal Boston, Donegal New York, all clubs that are well established and done well. But there's nothing in the Middle East, you know, in terms of bringing that Donegal name. So even we've had some people from Abu Dhabi, from Saudi Arabia, that have said, looking forward to getting into Dubai and getting a night out with all the Donegal ones. So it's brilliant, you know, almost building a center point for not just Donegal people, but of course, anybody that wants to get involved with the Irish community and the crack that's involved with that, you know.
Well, we've seen influences in the UAE taking over soccer, golf, boxing. Could we have a 50,000 GEA stadium next as part of Riyadh season? I don't know. You never know what could happen. But Liam, so what? I mean, so then how are you going to play games? I mean, you can't have a league as such. I don't know. Like, what? Where does this go from here? Because obviously you can get together. And
I'll give you a background on it. So, yeah, there's a number of GEA clubs. I think even here in the UAE right now, there might be eight GEA clubs. So there is a league, and the way it works is very similar to like a blitz format, you know, in terms of there'll be tournaments maybe once every 2 months where all clubs come together and play in a nine-a-side games. And it's very short because of the heat here. You can't play a 60-minute game or you'll probably die. Mm-hmm. So you have to play short games, and it's nine-a-side. But the interest around it is building. There's more clubs coming every year. Even the clubs from Qatar and Saudi, from Bahrain, they all come in for them tournaments, at least bring a team or two. So it's a different format than how it is at home, but there is competitive matches. And then the weekends that we don't have the tournaments, you can set up challenge matches with the other clubs, and that's what we're looking to try and do now with a lot of the chairmen of the different clubs, just trying to have competitive matches, yeah.
Yeah, and any former inter-county stars in there, or...?
Yeah, well, there's some good names, I suppose, in terms of like Conor Gibbons, for example, from Letterkenny. He's one of the committee members, a very good footballer. I think he was actually back in Letterkenny maybe 3-4 weeks ago playing a junior match, and he kicked 9 points. So you've got players like that are still, you know, very much active. Christopher Sweeney's one of the committee members from Gidor, who has an Ulster medal with Gidor, you know, and to name a few.
So there's a bit of talent there, no doubt about it.
Yeah, 100%. There's talent, and you know, we're welcoming anybody that is coming out here. Even if it is inter-county players, to come for a training session if they're out on holidays or if they're passing through to go to Australia, you know, that's what we want to see, is people coming down and mixing with other Donegal people. You know?
And what's the name of the club?
Donegal Dubai GAA.
Right, simple as that. And huge female participation as well. Is there the same network there for challenge games and blitzes and what have you?
Yeah, it's the exact same for the ladies. And it was something that, I suppose, when we started the club, we started it with just thinking about a men's team. And then there was a lot of messages from the ladies' side, so we decided to open up that. And Adele McFadden from Falcara is actually heading that up for us now, another Donegal woman. So she's going to look after the women's side. But yeah, the numbers on the women's are now creeping up as much as the men's. So we've got two very, very good sides of the club, yeah.
Brilliant. What's the weather like there at the moment, Liam?
I think we're looking about 40 today, so it's rotten, yeah. But it'll be interesting to train in tonight, 7 o'clock, to see how it goes.
All right, okay. Plenty of liquid. Get the liquid. I'd say there's plenty of liquid drank over there. But anyway, I mean water, obviously, and Lucozade and stuff like that. All right, Liam, listen, enjoy. Great little story. Thanks so much for sharing it with us. And best luck to you and all your friends and colleagues over there. Take care.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye. Thanks. That's Liam Doherty, chair of the Donegal Dubai GEA Club, talking to us live from Dubai. And you'd swear he was sitting in front of me. It's remarkable stuff altogether, isn't it? Greg, did the Catholic religious orders in Ireland take the words "suffer little children" the wrong way? Also, to compensate victims, cardinals and bishops could use some of the expensive bling. I'm sure Jesus himself would approve. In terms of redress, I understand where you're coming from. Let me see. I want to be really careful the subjects I'm jumping between, that it's not insensitive in any way, shape or form. I'll go back to the situation we were talking to Tanya earlier on about her son Oisin, who was told at 3 days' notice that there wouldn't be transport to bring him to college. While it's terrible that Oisin doesn't have transport, that family should count themselves very lucky that the child has a place and had a place to be educated. There's families fighting just to get their child assessed and have access to education. The whole system is a complete shambles. That family also, I presume, has had that battle and that fight to get to that point as well, and would have a very good understanding of what you're saying. I appreciate what you're saying. Hi there. I've been trying to... No, I can't read that because it's been blocked by the screenshot. The volume rocker is blocking. I can't read it. Don't want to misread it. I'll get back to that. People have been trying to make everyone aware of the proposed education for children for years. When you see who's been influencing the decision-making, you can understand why we have what is written in the books, anti-Irish, anti-family. Greg, you asked how these abusers get away with it. In 1947, a papal decree was issued which discouraged the laity from reporting crimes of the clergy to civil authorities, with the threat of the withdrawal of sacraments and Holy Communion. If any Catholic chose to do so, instead, the faithful were encouraged to report any abuse to the local bishop, who would then be charged with which way to proceed with any allegations made toward a member of the clergy. We all know how that turned out, Jim. Yeah, Jim, I appreciate it. I appreciate exactly what you're saying there. I have to take a very, very quick break, and then we're going to speak to a listener who was listening to Katrina's conversation and wants a quick word on that with us. Right, Patsy, good morning to you. Thanks so much for chatting to me.
Good morning, Greg. I was just listening to that woman telling her story, and of course anything to do with adoption and not seeing your mum is a very very heart-wrenching point for me, because I have never met my mum. And I just think the laws that were in place, I think, were quite cruel, that your mum, once you were up for adoption, you weren't allowed to meet her.
Patsy, how much of the story...
Anyhow, the good...
Okay,
am I on to you?
No, I was going to ask you, Patsy, if you didn't mind, how did you and your mother come to be parted?
I don't know. I was born in hospital in Coleraine. And so she must have been working, and I was in care with somebody in Coleraine for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then I was taken out of that care and placed in the Nazareth House until I was four and a half. And then I was adopted then by an elderly couple then when I was four and a half. And so therefore then I spent my life with them until I married, and well, I was almost 30. And I had never found my mum, never was told anything about her. I was told when I was 8 years of age that my father was killed in the war and my mother died at birth.
No, my word.
And that wasn't true.
So that really effectively at that point you would have taken that as fact and carried that into your teens and adulthood. But did you did you question that, Patsy, that tale that you were told?
I questioned then, from I was 14 then, you know, going through teenage years, I would have wanted to find out about my mum. I would have cried. I'd have wished for a photograph. I'd have wished that I would have had something belonging to her. And that was okay then. Then I was sent to a priest when I was 24, and he told me all about my mum, and that she was an only daughter, and she had me, and that she was thrown out of the house and never allowed back again. And he told me all about her, and then she'd went to England, and then he said then the last he heard about her, she was dead, but she wasn't dead. She didn't die for 12 years after. Then I finally discovered. And then I kept my father in the last 3 years, and 2 months before he died, I asked him one day, because I knew he was from the same area.
Well, can I ask, sorry, Patsy, you were told at 8... And is this your birth father that you managed to reconnect with, or your
Oh, no, the man that I was
raised
there
you.
With.
Okay, yeah.
The only father that I knew. Mm-hmm. And he told me all about, he knew my grandfather. He knew my grandfather, and they were from Fermanagh.
Mm-hmm.
And the man that reared me was from Fermanagh as well. So he knew all about the connection. So he was able to tell me quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, he died then a few months later. I had him in the last 3 years, and then he died. And after he died then, I started to find out about my mother's connection.
Mm-hmm.
And a year later, I found my uncle and his wife, Uncle Paul. And that was just heavenly. And he had five of a family, and we all met up. And that was the first time that we had cousins and an uncle and an aunt. And that was just absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But my daughter, from she was 7 years old, I told her when she was seven, and she insisted that I do a DNA. So that's why I'm coming on here today to say anybody that hasn't found out their relations, do DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's absolutely fantastic.
What did you find
as
out, Patsy?
As a result of DNA, I have found a sister in this last year.
Oh, wow. Is she alive, Patsy?
Right. She's alive. She has been here 3 times.
Oh, wow.
She has a son and a daughter. They have been here as well. And she is coming back this weekend. And she said she has won the lotto when she has found us and the six of a family, six cousins, because her husband had no family, no sisters or brothers, and so therefore her children had no relations.
No cousins.
And she was in the same boat as me. She was adopted, and had been adopted, and then she ended up in a convent, and then she finally went to London and became a nurse. And her life was a life without knowing anything at all about her mother. She found out in later years that who her mother was, and but she was in her 40s like myself. And then her son and daughter had done their DNA, and as a result, they contacted my daughter to say that they were coming up as being very close relations, and that they were getting their mum to do DNA. She done her DNA, and it came up as 96%. We have the same father.
Wow.
But a different mum. And so that's how I found my sister. So my advice to anybody out there is, if you're worried or wanting to find about your connection or your mum or father or anyone, that's the way to go.
So people are going to ask you, did you do it through one of these sort of, did you do it through one of these genealogy websites or something? Or what?
No, my daughter got the test pack and she sent it off.
Okay. So you know, your sister that you found, you share a father but a different mother?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. But but the stories are very similar, obviously, in terms of knowing each of your mums and searching for, I suppose, who you are and other family members. This the experience you both went through seems similar.
Both of us are very, very similar. She never found out who her mum was. It was all top secret as well. And like mine, and we seem to have just no rights, you know, and it's very, very sad.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, I think that everybody's entitled to know your roots.
100%.
And especially when it comes to illness and all that sort of thing.
Listen,
as well.
How many times have you gone into the GP, Patsy, and they've said, is there any history of such and such in your family? You don't have that knowledge.
Times. No,
yeah.
No, umpteen times.
Yeah.
And it's just wonderful. And I couldn't describe it. As I said, I've been very lucky because I've met a lot of lovely, good friends and cousins, you know, adopted cousins, which were absolutely brilliant. But this is the icing on the cake, just to meet up with a sister. I just can't explain the happiness that both of us have, and it's just wonderful.
So pleased. Because this was with you all your life, of course, Patsy. I mean, you get on with life, don't you? You work and relationships and you have children, but it's always there. Who am I? Who's out there? Where's mom?
Yeah.
Where was dad? Yeah. Do I have any uncles?
Yeah.
Do I have nephews and nieces?
Yeah.
And all those questions
you're always,
were answered. Yeah.
you're always treated as, oh, that's the one that was reared with so and so, or, you know, or you always feel lost.
And can I ask, and not personal, but you kind of said it, Patsy, but your father that raised you, he told you about your background shortly before he died. Was that a timing coincidence, or did he want to relieve himself of that burden to you? Was he conscious that his time on earth was short?
He would have been conscious, of course, that his time on earth was short, because he would have called me into the room. He had a wee room on his own here, and he would have called me into the room, and he'd have given me instructions about what he wanted when he died.
Yeah.
You know, all these. So, of course, he was conscious that he...
So he said to you at one stage, he says, look, I have information I haven't told you up until now. Here it is.
No, I asked him. Right. I went this day and went straight and I asked him. I said, Daddy, my mum came from an Askelen direction, and I said, you're from the same area, and you're bound to have known who they were. And of course he blurted straight out, oh sure, I knew your granda, and named him, and he knew my granny and named her and told me. So at least I had that information from that on.
Okay. It's a wonderful story, Patsy, about you and your sister connecting.
Isn't it just wonderful? You know, so and I know that there are people out there, because a few people have said to me that they have sons or daughters or mothers or that, and they would love to find out more. So I just say to them, right, DNA is the way.
Right. You or maybe your daughter might send on, because I know, Patsy, people will be inquiring. You or your daughter might pass on the actual service that you used, and we can pass it on to any listeners that give us a ring, if that's okay.
Well, indeed.
Lovely,
Greg,
Patsy.
Well, indeed.
Good. And all our love to your sister as well when you see her next. She's on her way back again.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Patsy.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, there you go. That's Patsy's story. If you've got a similar story to share, feel free to do so. 086 60 25000 is the text or WhatsApp number, or you might prefer to call us. 07491 25000. If you're calling from the north or outside of the Republic, it's 00353 749125000.